What's up, everybody? My name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition, and you are tuned in to the 100th episode of Kinda Neat. We finally did it. Hey, I don't know, nobody else is in the room clapping. That's fine. It took us a little longer than it should have. Like, we probably should have hit 100 episodes in 100 weeks, if my math serves me correct, which means that it should have been last year, but that's okay. We got here. We still got to 100 episodes, and we're still going, and that's something. And on our 100th episode, we talked to Daddy Kev, who is one of the guys that helps make this show happen. Without the space that he has created at Cosmic Zoo in Atwater Village, we would not be able to do this show, or at least we would not be able to do this show with the amount of quality and precision that we are able to do because of the studio that he has set up here. But beyond that, Daddy Kev is just... he's a person in LA that is such a connector, such a catalyst for so many various movements and projects that have happened. And he's a mentor to so many people, including myself. And so we just wanted to take our 100th episode to like hear the story of the guy that helps make this show happen and the guy that makes so many other things in Los Angeles happen, including Low End Theory, including Alpha Pup Records, and dozens and dozens of other things that some of you guys probably enjoy. First things first. It has been 100 episodes, like I just said, and we are coming up on our 3-year anniversary. So Ben and I are going to ask for you guys' help. We have started a Patreon, a pledge drive on Patreon, and Patreon is basically a website upon which you can pledge money either by the month or per episode. That's the choice that we make, but make it per episode. So basically, if you like our show and you want it to remain commercial free as it has always been, and you want to help us with our overhead and you want to put some extra money in our pocket because we work very hard to bring you guys free content every week, then you can go to patreon.com and search for Kinda Neat. And basically, you just pledge an amount of money per episode. My hopes, I'll tell you the honest truth. My hope is that I can get like 200 people to pledge $1 per episode. That would help with the show so much because it would just be a little less stress for us. And it would help pay the bills around the studio a little better, which is never a bad thing. I'm not telling you that you have to go do it. It's optional. The show's always going to remain free. I'm hoping that the show can always remain commercial free. The YouTube shit, I'll tell you, it just doesn't really make us any money. And it's starting to be something where, you know, Ben and I are pretty much breaking even every month. And I'm not trying to be all woe is me. I'm just like trying to put some money in our pockets, to be honest. And so we love you guys and we love the support that you guys have given us. And we just hope that we'll see a little bit of that love back. No harm, no foul. If you don't pledge, it's fine. It's fine. I don't know how it's going to work. I'm excited to see how it's going to work. We're going to let it run and just see what happens. You know, it's weird. I get like a little butterflies in my stomach thinking about it, like I'm nervous as to whether or not anyone's going to show up to the Patreon party, but we shall see. Anyway, yeah, go to patreon.com, pledge a couple bucks. It would be a major help. And, last episode with Dizzy Wright, you heard me talking about the fact that I was going to be headed to Mammoth to go snowboard, and I did, and it was already like almost a month ago now, for Christ's sakes. We waited too long to put this episode out. That's fine, though, and it was good. I woke up so early. Anytime that I'm going on a snowboard trip, I wake up at like 5 in the morning, like it's Christmas or something, and I was like so excited. I was like just laying in bed, rolling around, going like, I should just leave now, even though I couldn't check into the cabin that we got until like 4 o'clock anyways. So I ended up getting on the road at 7, and I'm like damn near there at like noon or something. I'm like so close. I had already passed Bishop, and after you pass Bishop on the way to Mammoth, you're like almost there. And so I'm fucking flying, dude. There's no traffic and I'm just cruising. And all of a sudden I see a car up in the distance pulled over to the side and I go, oh fuck, that doesn't look like a cop car, but it probably is. And I look down and I'm going 84 or 85 maybe. And I like kind of hit my brakes and panic. And then all of a sudden, of course, those lights come on. And I end up getting a goddamn speeding ticket, but the cop was cool. You know, I tried to talk my way out of it. Like, oh, you know, I'm just driving out here and my car is so small and I heard there's a storm coming, so I'm trying to beat the storm, so I apologize for driving so fast. He's like, well, that's no excuse. You were doing 84 and a 65, but I'll tell you what, I'll knock it down to 80. because that's the lowest tier of fee or whatever. So at least it gave me, I guess, a little bit of a kickback, but still, it's expensive as shit. And I got a parking ticket, or I got a speeding ticket, and I haven't had one of those in like almost 6 years. So I'm bummed about that. Now I got to take driver's ed school and all that bullshit. But while we were at Mammoth, crazily enough, particularly now in hindsight because of how fucking hot it's been, but while we were there, it snowed 4 feet in like 3 nights or 3 days. Got there on a Friday, stayed Saturday, Sunday, and left on Monday. And by the time I was leaving on Monday morning, my car was buried literally in 4 feet of snow, and I had to dig it out. And I haven't seen that much snow in forever. Like, I don't think Mammoth has seen that much snow in forever. The only problem with that is that most people that don't ski or snowboard, they think like, oh, if you go and it starts snowing, those are the best conditions to ride in. Like, you're so lucky it's going to snow. Truth be told is that you want to try to get there the day after it snows, when you've got all that fresh snow and you try to get out there in the morning early. Yeah, the best time to ride is what they call a bluebird day, where it's like stop snowing and the next day the sky is clear. So while we're there, it's dumping the whole fucking time. And on Saturday, that first day, there were also gusts of wind like 35 to 40 miles an hour. So that combined with the snow equals pretty much zero visibility. So about 3/4 of the lifts were closed on the mountain. And so you're paying like full price for these lift tickets, and you really only get to ride like one or two lifts the whole day, which kind of sucks. But at the same time, my friend and I, we found like some pretty cool tree runs, and while some of the day was an absolute bitch, some of the runs were like the best that I've ever had in my life. Like perfectly fresh tracks through the trees, that just these virgin, beautiful powder tracks. It was so awesome. The other thing that happened there is that the coolies went with us. You guys, if you pay attention, you know who my homie Dom is and his three kids that are my little nephews. And Gavin, the middle kid, he is 8 now. He turned 8 the day while we were there. Like Friday was his birthday, or that Friday was his birthday. And it was only his second time snowboarding. And the first day he couldn't go out because the conditions were so extreme. But the second day it eased up just a little bit. Like the wind stopped, so it was only just snowing. And we took him out, and I swear by the end of the day, he got so good so fast that like by the end of the day, it wasn't like, oh, cute, I have my little nephew that I can snowboard with. It was like, it wasn't like having a little kid that I was snowboarding with. It was just like having a friend that was like good enough to keep up. It was so crazy how fast he picked it up. It was really awesome. And so I'm stoked that now it's going to be something that we can go do. I don't know. I'm just hyped that like we have an activity that he's hyped on, and that I've been hyped on since I was his age, that we can share in. He, you know, riding up the lift, he'd be like, oh, Uncle Lee, this is so amazing. Like, I think I want to buy a house here when I get older. And I'm like, keep dreaming, young man, because the housing market is too terrible for that. But yeah, so overall, the Mammoth trip was cool, other than the fact I got a goddamn speeding ticket, son of a bitch. So yeah, now I've been home for a couple of weeks, and the year's off to a slow start. I'll be honest, I haven't really had much work in the last couple weeks or month. I mean, the first 2 months, barely any work, to be honest, which is cool, but which also kind of sucks. It's cool because I save enough money. I've saved money and put away money to where I'm like not panicking about not having any income right now. But at the same time, I get a little stir crazy and I go a little nuts when I don't have busy hands. Like, I like to stay busy so I don't have to think about all my mental shit, all my depression and anxiety and stuff. Like, when I'm busy, I don't have any of that stuff. So in order to like remain busy during those times, I've just been, you know, going to the gym. When it's hot out, I've been to the beach a couple times, try to go on some hikes and shit. You know, real stereotypical LA fuckboy shit, I guess. But that's okay. When you're not busy, you got to make yourself busy. So anyway, in summary, we made it to 100 episodes. I'm so grateful that you guys have stayed along in the journey with me. I'm so thankful for the YouTube community that we have created. I feel like it's such a positive fucking YouTube community as opposed to a lot of the other YouTube communities that I have seen. I think, like, you know, even when we get like the random asshole who's like, man, fuck this, this guy sucks, you know, we get dozens of other people coming in and saying like, hey, man, music doesn't suck. It's objective, and or it's subjective, and it's just not for you, man. And I'm like, I am proud of my young Padawan music listeners. Thank you for sticking up for what we believe in on YouTube. And so, yeah, all that to say, if you like the podcast, if you like the YouTube video, go to the Patreon, kick in a couple bucks. It will go a very far way for us, and we appreciate that. So now we're going to get into the conversation with my man, Daddy Kev. And like I was just talking about a second ago about trying to like stay busy and stay motivated, this is a dude who doesn't have any problem with that. And we kind of get into that. I've always been curious how he kind of he balances and juggles so many things between being a record label owner, being a studio owner, and a mastering engineer and mixing engineer. Like, he's amazing at both of those things, but also finding time to find new artists, put new artists on. You know, he's not the reason, but definitely a part of the reason that some of your favorite musicians are in your fucking phone right now. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like without Daddy Kev, there are definitely, you know, a lot of your brain feeder artists that are in your ear holes right now. Like, you might not have found them as easy. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, I've always been curious about how he stays so motivated to manage so many different things with the nightclub, with the studio, with the label, because it's very inspiring. It's inspiring. That's what it is. So that's why Daddy Kev is our 100th episode, because he kind of ties together all the plot holes with, you know, we've been trying to like get to the bottom of the low end theory origin story ever since I started doing podcasts. And so, you know, it's all kind of come together. If you go listen to the episodes that we've done with all the residents, and this is maybe the final piece of that puzzle. So without further ado, after 100 long rambling intros, this is another long rambling intro. Here is our 100th episode with the guy who helps bring it to you, Daddy Kev. Yesterday is your first Grammys Awards that you went to?
That is correct. Yes, sir.
Well, how was the experience?
You know, it was interesting. You know, being a nominee was very cool.
Yeah.
The treatment is a little different, but yeah, it was cool. I got to see a lot of friends and, just see the process a bit.
What'd you wear on the red carpet?
I was wearing a tuxedo.
Oh shit.
Oh yeah. I was all decked out.
Suited and booted.
Oh yeah.
Hell yeah, man.
First time since prom.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you built a lifestyle where you get to wear jeans and t-shirts pretty much every day, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Pretty much.
How was that feeling when you found out that you're a Grammy nominee?
It was surreal. I mean...
Because approximately how many years have you been working in what you would call the music industry?
Since 92.
So that's like, what, 34 years?
24 years.
I'm horrible at math.
24 years in the game, yeah.
Shout out to Common Core. I need help with that. 24 years in the game, that's fantastic. And do you feel like it's one of your – is it one of your proudest moments? Is it up there?
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, part of it, though, I mean, I don't make music for accolades.
Right.
You know, I do pretty underground, you know, stuff. So something like the Grammys is not – on the docket,
right,
usually.
Right.
So that was kind of, to me, the cool thing is just, you know, doing music that I love and that being what breaks through.
Right. And even with that being said, not making music for the accolades, like, I would say overall, you're like a behind the scenes dude. You're the dude that's behind the guys making shit happen. You know what I mean? And I feel like you're not somebody who really, you don't care about the credit. You care about getting shit done. Right?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely. I mean, my artist career ended many years ago.
Right.
You know, the idea of pursuing an artist career, that was something I was trying to do in the 90s.
Yeah.
And really is not part of my, you know, what I'm pursuing at this point.
Right. What are you pursuing at this point? What would you say? Does it ever get easier to define what the life goal is?
I mean, I feel my role is that of a facilitator.
Yeah.
So that involves, you know, putting other people's, you know, careers and artistry ahead of mine. That goes from, you know, being a label owner, being an engineer, being a club promoter, an event promoter. You know, it's about propelling other people's careers first.
Right. You're from California. You're from Los Angeles, yeah?
Born and raised, yes.
Born and raised.
Yes.
What part of town are you born in?
Harbor City.
Where's that?
That is South LA off the 110 freeway.
Okay.
So kind of between, you know, it's right near Carson.
Like Carson. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And what kind of family are you born into?
You know, my family has been in Los Angeles for a long time. My grandfather went to Manual Arts in the 20s.
Wow.
So, you know, I've been here. I mean, my family's been here for a long time.
Yeah.
And my dad was from China.
Uh-huh.
And met my mom in Inglewood. They met and married in Inglewood.
How did they meet in Inglewood?
You know, they were living in the same apartment building.
Oh, okay.
And
convenient.
Yep. And my dad.
How'd your dad end up over here from China?
It was the revolution.
Oh, okay.
And so they fled. They lived in what was then Canton,
yeah.
And went to Hong Kong, and then he went to San Francisco when they arrived, and then eventually made his way down here.
Wow, that's crazy. Did he tell a lot of stories about that time of his life, or like the struggles kind of getting from over there to over here?
A bit. I mean, it was pretty dramatic during the. When they fled, he had three older brothers who didn't make it.
Oh, wow.
You know,
yeah.
from the war and the Japanese occupation. So, you know, there was a lot of that that, you know, he didn't really feel comfortable talking about because of how, you know, traumatic, you know, that is. And,
yeah.
You know, coming from, you know, dealing with full-blown war, you know, scenario.
Right.
So, and he didn't. He always just wanted, you know, I have one brother, an older brother. He just wanted us to, you know, live the American dream, basically.
Right, right. And then so your mom's side is the generational Angelinos?
Yes.
And so they've been here for what, like 4 or 5 generations, something? Or?
Yeah. I mean, at least 4 now. Yeah.
And yeah. Are they Latino or are they white?
Whatever. White, yeah.
Yeah, white. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. What was your grandfather's racket in Los Angeles back then? You said he was in the arts?
No, I mean, he went to Manual Arts high school.
Oh, high school. Okay. Yeah,
which
yeah.
is like one of the ones right near USC, South Central.
Okay, okay.
They used to live off 50th Street.
Uh-huh.
They were into a bunch of different things. My grandmother, she was an artist.
Oh, wow.
And they just did that
yeah.
you know, for a long time.
Yeah.
And yeah, and then my mom, you know, they met my dad in the 60s. And then my dad was, you know, the main breadwinner.
Was your mom artistic?
You know, she was always a really good writer.
Yeah.
But my grandmother was a really great visual artist.
Okay.
And then they had, you know, my brother and I involved in music stuff really early.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, in hindsight, where do you think the early love of music came from?
I mean, they loved listening to music.
Yeah.
And
what was floating through the airwaves in your household?
My dad was a big jazz guy.
Okay. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So like, you know, Coltrane, Miles Davis,
yeah.
My mom was a huge Beatles person.
Okay.
So that was my main regimen from them growing up. And then I took piano lessons from age 6. I did that for a few years. And then I got to elementary school. I did trumpet for 6 years.
Okay. Yeah. Nice. And so you're growing up in like what? Late 70s, early 80s in Los Angeles. It was a turbulent time around here, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, that was
the beginning of the crack epidemic or what?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up, you know, for the most part in the 80s. I graduated from high school in 92.
Yeah.
I went to Narbonne. I went to LAUSD, you know, K through 12.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I was, you know, ground zero for a lot of that.
Right.
You know, I had like 3 friends get killed when I was in high school.
Oh, shit.
You know, so I was in the middle of it.
Yeah, like South LA is pretty, it was a violent area at the time.
Yeah, especially Harbor area.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing the most down there, arguably.
What kind of, was it gang culture?
Yeah.
What kind of gangs was it? Like Bloods and Crips, or was it also?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those two.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of, you know, I grew up with a lot of Samoans.
I was,
you know?
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah.
You know, Frank from Low End.
Right, right.
We were, you know, we grew up together
uh-huh.
from the Sandbox and, yeah, I mean, I was, you know, it was hard to escape it if you went to public school.
Yeah. At the time, in context, did you feel that? Like, was it scary to be out in your neighborhood, or was it just kind of like, oh, this is just what life is? Do you know what I mean? Like, was there a sense of anxiety in the air, or did you just feel as though you were having a normal childhood?
I mean, at the time, you feel like you're having a normal childhood.
I mean,
I grew up 2 doors down from a crack house, you know?
So, oh, wow.
I mean, and right on a corner that was pretty busy, Sepulveda, Vermont. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, there'd be, you know, I don't know, robberies at least once a month, you know,
oh, wow.
going on at one of those, you know, either the Kmart or the Zodis. And, you know, it was pretty active. in that way.
Yeah. When you went to school, I bet you have stories of like people that you went to school with that people would be surprised to hear. Los Angeles people always have stories about like, oh, I went to elementary school with so-and-so that went on to do this.
For the most part, I mean, when I was in high school, I went to high school with Imani from Farside.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, I mean, that area, there's not too many success stories.
Right.
You know, so, you know, probably one of the biggest ones that went to my high school would have been Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, no shit.
Who dropped out from Narbonne. I think Bo Derek went there.
Okay.
You know, but, you know, there's not, I mean, since then it's become a big football high school. So there's all these NFL guys, but, you know.
That's not where you started making, like, your main musical connections? Or?
No. No. Not at all. I mean, not at all. My main musical connections started when I was in high school. It was the birth of the rave scene in LA.
Okay.
And I got an internship at Herb Magazine.
Oh.
So that was my entry.
When did Herb start?
91.
Okay. And so you got an internship, like, what, your junior, senior year in high school?
My senior year.
Senior year. Mm-hmm. And what were you doing for them?
Mainly design.
Yeah.
Back then.
Right.
I'd been involved with my school newspaper, high school newspaper and junior high, and, you know, was really into graphic design. And, you know, then I started writing for the magazine a little bit after that. But that was my entry. And then I started doing clubs, you know, events that summer.
Oh, already? That's like 92. An 18-year-old.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So were they sending you to events at first? Or, like, what was your intro into the rave scene in L.A.? Like, how did you find out about it?
You know, there was this article in Details Magazine about this club or this party that used to happen called Double Hit Mickey. Uh-huh. And after I read that, I just wanted to learn more about it.
And where was that party? Yeah, in L.A. or New York? Or
that was in L.A., yeah. Oh, okay. So that was just, you know, wherever they could do locations. That was thrown by Gary Richards, who went on to do Hard.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
I became, like, one of his main flyer guys. You know?
Right.
So in addition to doing my own parties, you know, I was a flyer kid for Double Hit Mickey.
So how did you break into that? Like, when I get emails and stuff, one of the main questions people send me that either follow the show or follow the music, they go, how can I get involved in the scene? And it's like a lot of kids aren't willing to, like, just go break down the door and take that step. So, like, how did you go from a high school kid that had an internship into, like, I'm going to go to this party that I like and I'm going to fucking work for the dude?
I mean, he just gave me a shot.
You know?
I was, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And,
yeah.
You know,
were you just showing up to all the parties?
I was going to all the parties. And that summer, I mean, I was going out to, you know, when it was usually on the weekends when these clubs would crack.
Mm-hmm.
I would go to 2 or 3 or 4 parties a night.
Wow.
You know, promoting.
Yeah.
So he knew I was really effective.
Yeah.
And really dedicated and a cool kid. You know, I wasn't all drugged out. So I really wanted to be involved.
Where were the parties at back then? Was it like the modern scene where they're just in warehouses downtown and shit?
I mean, it was all over LA. They would do warehouses. I mean, downtown was definitely a part of it. You know, I remember one party I helped promote was at the Morongo, Indian Reservation.
Yeah.
National Indoor Swap Meet in Compton. The cool thing about Double Hit Mickey, they would do sometimes these really weird locations. So they did like Wild Rivers and Irvine, Water Park.
Yeah.
Rave stuff before, you know, these people knew what a rave was or even knew what we were up to. You know?
Right. And so how they would just get the water park to, like, stay open late or something?
All night.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's tight.
Yeah, man.
That's
super
tight. And so that was like a scene that was getting inspired from European raves or what? Did they start in London or England or something?
I mean, the music did.
Yeah.
I mean, the acid house stuff and then DJs from there, like Michael Cook, came here and then, at that point, it became, at least musically, it was, you know, an emulation. And then New York had a cool thing going on. They had a bunch of great artists like, you know, Frankie Bones, who was doing, you know, who also took what was happening in Europe, started doing it in New York. And then, you know, I remember the acts that we'd bring out, like the big headliners would usually be from New York or the UK.
Okay.
And then at that point, there was an LA scene that was bubbling, you know, so we had our own DJ heroes like DJ Dan or Rondi Core. And, you know, Steve Loria, you know, R.A.W., you know, Six Block, he's from that era. And it was really exciting back then, you know.
What was the name of the first show that you threw? Do you remember?
I mean, technically it would have been some of the parties I was promoting, you know, insofar as, you know, literally not promoting from an event organization point of view, but like getting the word out would have been Double Hit Mickey. And then, you know, back then I had another pseudonym. I used to go by the Boy Wonder. And there was this guy I knew from South Central, Mr. Neat, that we would do these parties, you know?
And,
I forget. Like, I think the first one I ever did was, it was, you know, back then it was, a lot of the themes were based on cartoons. Ren and Stimpy
was
like this, you know, favorite of ours. So we did this one called Happy Happy Joy Joy.
Oh, right.
I think that was my first legit solo party, maybe.
Yeah. How many people do you think showed up?
I don't know. 80.
How did that feel?
Great. Yeah. I mean, we pulled it off. We had a map point. My brother worked the map point.
When you say map point, what do you mean? Like, okay, this is like pre-internet pretty much. Like nobody's on like Twitter talking about here RSVP to the address. Well, so it's
back then it was all like voicemails, you know, so you would have a phone number that would be on your flyer.
How would on the flyer. So people would call the voicemail and the voicemail would say, oh, meet here.
Go to this area.
Yeah.
And then you'd have guys there with the map.
Wow.
They'd hand out the map.
Yeah.
The map takes you to the party.
Well, that's crazy.
I mean, sometimes you'd have multiple map locations depending how, you know, illegal the party was.
Right. Were parties getting burnt pretty often or no? Or like, because the whole point of hiding the party is so the cops don't show up. So how often would the cops show up?
You know, too often. I mean, but you know, one of my big parties, this one party called The Gift that we got. Yeah, we got majorly popped on. But that was a big warehouse that we found off of, I want to say it was like right where the 105 and the 110 meet.
Okay, yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of people. It was at least 500 people at this party.
Oh, wow.
And
when you say majorly popped, like, I feel like nowadays cops might give a ticket if you're throwing a party. Like, what was it then? Did you guys get cuffed up and go to jail or what?
No, we ran. I mean, yeah, we bailed.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as, you know, we kind of lost control of the party, basically. Yeah. So, yeah, we just got the sound system and got out of there.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
When does the shift come from throwing the parties into, like, making, like, being involved in making the music? Or was it always kind of tied hand in hand?
Well, I was doing a lot of that in the beginning more. I mean, I was DJing back then, too.
Okay.
So I was DJing from junior high. So after I, you know, it was me when I was playing trumpet and stuff, what led me to stop that was getting into DJing.
So you got some turntables? Like, did you have your own setup?
My neighbor had a set.
Yeah.
And then we, you know, I kind of fell in love with it back then. And then when I graduated high school and went to college, my brother and I threw down together for a pair of 1200s.
What kind of stuff are you spinning in junior high? Is it like freestyle stuff?
Yeah.
Or
freestyle, you know, Trenier, you know, Stevie B.
Yeah.
And then early LA rap stuff. There was this record store in Carson near Scottsdale that they had all the early NWA stuff, and you know, we were buying all the Ruthless Records stuff.
Right.
You know, early on.
Yeah. Okay. So you're already DJing. So would you throw the parties in order to also DJ at the parties?
So my neighbor Ron, he was the dude who had the 1200 or who had the turntables. His dad bought for him.
Right.
And then there was this other dude from our neighborhood, Rodney Martin, who was a mobile DJ. And he had all these contracts with the LAUSD. So this dude was doing gigs every weekend, like high school and junior high school dances. So we became his roadies, basically. And he, you know, he was getting paid pretty well, at least by my standards at that point, you know, $400 to $500 to do these high school dances.
And because side note, LAUSD, that's the school district out here for the regional. But go ahead.
And then he would pay us $20 each.
Yeah.
You know, we'd show up after, you know, Friday night, 6 o'clock. We'd load up his van. We'd go to his house, load up his van with all the equipment, do all the work. We'd drive to the venue. We'd unload it all, set it all up.
Yeah.
And then he'd let us DJ.
So that was, you guys were record carriers, and at that time, that was the route into getting to DJ. It was like, yo, you do the work, and then you'll get some of the spoils.
And you can open up, you know, so he let us DJ for like the first hour.
Yeah.
And then he would DJ, you know, prime time. And then gig would end. He'd go get, you know, settle.
And we'd
pack it all up.
Yeah.
And it was the best job in the world.
And so what, you were like 16, 17 doing that?
Yeah.
That's
15,
tight.
16, 17. And, you know, it was cool. I got to go all city. I got to DJ at all these dances, you know, all over LA. You know.
As Wonder Boy.
No, at that point I didn't even have a name. I just Boy Wonder was
Boy Wonder,
was my, you know, promoter name. But Yeah, it was just, you know, it wasn't even like that. We weren't billed, you know?
Right, right, right.
Just Kev, you know?
Yeah. And, at that time, would you be DJing, but also get on the mic and say something? Or was it just like spin records?
We would just spin records, yeah. And we had a DJ crew back then. It was called Finesse Productions. That was like my DJ crew.
Right. Know? Back then, were people getting into turntablism a little bit? Like, you had a mixer and everything. Are you juggling at all and stuff like that?
We're trying. Yeah. I mean, you know, at that point, the mixers weren't built for it as much, but I mean, we were heavily inspired by like the DMC videos and all the battle stuff. And,
yeah.
Know, some of our local heroes were like, you know, Joe Cooley and, you know, of course, R.I.W., who used to go by DJ One-on-One. In Carson, there was a venue called Samarica Hall where a lot of these, you know, battles would take place back in the day. And, you know, it was a huge, you know, huge thing for us.
When I think of like Daddy Kev as an artist, like I learned about the show promotion stuff later from you. The way that my head instantly linked to you was like as a record producer. And so when did you start meeting the dudes that would go on to become like Project Blodians that you worked with? Like, were you going to the Good Life and stuff like that?
No, I had moved back from college. I went to college at UCSD and I kept doing shows down there. And moved back to LA, uh-huh. And then I got a job in the record business, working at Sire Records.
What was Sire Records about?
It was just it was like a Warner subsidiary.
Okay.
Founded by Seymour Stein, the guy who like found Madonna and uh-huh. all that.
Uh-huh.
And I was living, when I moved back, I was living in Wilmington because I had an old friend from high school that had a room open.
Uh-huh.
And then he was a rapper.
Uh-huh.
Underground dude, and he was he knew LAJ from the Shapeshifters.
Oh, okay.
So I started hanging out with, you know, at Jay's house, just, you know, he had an NPC, and at that point he was the most famous producer I knew.
Okay.
He had done like production for Tony and Vanessa Williams, had like multiple, you know, gold and platinum records on his wall.
Oh, no shit.
And so I was watching him, and then when I was working at Sire, they were trying to sign this new artist named Hive. And it was funny. They, you know, they tried to, you know, they knew I was one of the only dudes working there who smoked weed. So one day they were like, the A&R was like, yeah, man, take him downstairs and, you know, smoke some weed with them.
Yeah.
It's a parking lot. I was like, okay. And I had this DJ Premier Crooklyn Cuts mixtape. We're listening to it, and we just made a connection. You know, he was living in San Pedro at the time.
Uh-huh.
So, and then I think he was, if I remember correctly, also selling weed at the time, terrible weed. So I got his number. I was like, yeah, man, I'll hit you up, you know, to get some weed from you.
Right.
And we ended up clicking. You know, Hive had a studio. He was a dude who recorded Beneath the Surface.
Okay.
So I went over there for one of those sessions just to hang out.
Uh-huh.
And then he needed to move. I wanted to move out of Wilmington. So we moved in together in, I want to say it was 1997.
Well, I have two questions that popped
up. Sure.
You went to USD, you said?
UC San Diego.
UC San Diego. And so what did you study in college?
Philosophy.
Philosophy? Yeah. No shit. You were like, I'm really going to be in the music industry.
So, you know, I looked at the course catalog and I was like, all right, which has the smallest amount of requirements?
There you go. Okay. And so then Beneath the Surface, that was like a radio show?
No, that was a compilation, like a Project Blow 2 type compilation that was produced by Omid.
Okay.
They had Fellowship on there and had all the, you know, LA Cool and all a bunch of Good Lifers and Project Blodians were on there.
And then what kind of rapper was Hive?
Like, I wasn't a rapper. He was a producer.
Oh, he was a producer.
And turned into a drum and bass guy.
Okay. So back to your story. You move in Wilmington or you move out of Wilmington? What did you say?
I move out of Wilmington. Yeah. He moves out of San Pedro and he had a dope studio. I mean, he had, you know, back then, this is before computers, so he had like multiple ADATs, 24-channel Mackie board, a bunch of effects. And we moved to Mount Washington into a house that became, we called it the Auditorium, where we launched Celestial Recordings out of and recorded a bunch of, you know, great records down there.
I think maybe a lot of people don't know this about you that just know the name Daddy Kev, but you're like a world-class engineer and also just like a gearhead, because people might only know your business acumen or might only know your production credits, but they don't realize that you're also like a sonic wizard. So at that time when you're seeing these studios like Hive Studio and you see the ADATs and stuff, were you already really intrigued with gear?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I knew what that stuff was. I mean, I recognized, you know, the quality that you could get from that gear.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and then we then he had a friend, this dude Phoenix Orion.
Oh, yeah, I know who Phoenix Orion is.
Who then, you know, he was always hanging out at the house. And, yeah, and then my first record that I did significant production on would have been Phoenix Orion's first album.
When was this, like around 96, 97?
This is, we recorded it in 97 and it came out summer of 98.
Summer of 98, yeah. Okay. I have a funny Phoenix Orion story.
I'm sure you do.
Does everybody?
I think so.
I was at a show, and I think it's maybe an infamous show, where, like, I think maybe he was opening for Cool Keith and Pomona or something, and he came out in, like, a full-on leather biker outfit, but had it kind of, like, decked out with extra alien stuff on it, and maybe, like, a hand over, like, a mannequin hand over his crotch, and, like, the crowd started getting a little restless, and he was like, I'll come out in the crowd and fight you guys. And lo and behold, he jumped into the crowd and socked somebody. And that was, like, legendary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, those were wild times.
Yeah.
Back
yeah,
then.
Yeah. So you produced the whole record for him?
I did about half of it.
Yep. Yeah. And what was your technique? Like, did you have your own MPC at this time?
I did.
And so what kind of stuff were you sampling? Like, what was talking to you at the time?
I mean, you know, I was a crate digger. So it was, you know, obscure jazz stuff.
Yeah.
Breaks. And, yeah, I mean, we had great chemistry. That was some, you know, that was my, I learned a lot from those days.
It seems like
music, you know?
In the West Coast underground, like on the East Coast underground, it seemed like people did a lot of digging into soul samples. And on the West Coast underground, it seemed like jazz was really talking to you guys more out here. Like, why do you think that was?
I mean, I think it was just contagious, you know?
Yeah.
And it was also, you know, based upon our template record, was, you know, Fellowship's first album.
Yeah.
So that was, if there was any one we were trying to sound like, it was, you know, like JMD and, you know, what they did on Inner City Griots, you know?
Yeah, right. And when you're working with Phoenix at that point, had you met the Fellowship dudes yet?
No. So Phoenix's cousin from New York was Supernatural.
Oh, yeah.
So because of the success of his first album, he was like, all right, my cousin's going to fly out here. And we clicked immediately. So we started working with Super Nat. I produced the B-side of one of his first 12-inches of that era, this thing that came out in 99. And then it was after that, then Super Nat started working with Peace on a project and then started bringing Peace around.
Oh, so Peace was your entryway into the Fellowship?
Yes.
Okay.
So then we became really good friends, and then I was producing Peace material.
Were those guys just already LA legends at that point?
Oh,
like,
yeah. I mean,
they were like mythological characters?
That was the highest level.
Yeah.
You know? And so then, yeah, we clicked immediately, and then Concrete Jungle, my first weekly club, started in 99. And that became then the, you know, the focal point for where we would all hang out and, you know, kind of like an early Lowen Theory.
Yeah. So tell me about the conception of Concrete Jungle, because I think, like, at this point, that's something that maybe a lot of younger cats don't even know about.
I mean, it was at the time, you know, it was an extension of a New York club. Again, Phoenix knew the dude who started the original Concrete Jungle.
Oh, okay.
We started the LA version of it that had two rooms. We did it at Spaceland, which is now the Satellite.
Yeah.
So we had drum and bass in the big room and then hip hop in the back room. And then the residents were myself, DJ Hive, you know, who was doing the drum bass stuff, and then Edit from Glitch Mob.
Oh, yeah.
Who went, you know, who back then was called Con Artist. And then another dude.
He must have been young at that point, huh?
Very young. He was in college at USC.
Yeah.
And, and then we did that for a little over 2 years Wednesday.
Would you mainly be in the drum and bass room DJing, or in the hip hop room, or both?
I started mainly in the drum and bass room, and towards the end I was just doing the back room.
Okay.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff were you spinning at that time?
You know, I mean, the drum and bass, it was whatever the hot thing coming out of the UK was, but...
Well, like hip-hop wise, because I feel like you're an anti-establishment hip-hop dude, kind of.
Well, back then, yeah, it was, you know.
So I mean, sure it wasn't Nelly.
I mean, I was playing beats, you know. I was playing, you know, Moax stuff, DJ Shadow, you know, I was playing, you know, Company Flow.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. And then we had these cyphers that would go down back there all the time. So
who'd be in them?
I mean, we made Peace one of the early residents, and then Micah 9.
Oh, okay.
So it was Peace and Micah. Since we had those two, you know, you'd have a lot of guys showing up. Uh-huh. So bus driver was another one of the people who was there all the time.
And he was a young gun back then.
Yeah, very young. Woes, another dude who was there all the time. And we had, like, you know, De La Soul come through there.
Oh, no shit.
Mos Def come through. I mean, it was a spot. It was the spot for that kind of, you know, underground weekly type of, you know, experience.
What day did you throw that event?
That was on Wednesdays.
That was also on Wednesdays.
Yes, sir.
Why did you choose Wednesdays?
You know, it just seemed like an open night.
Because now Wednesdays are still legendary in your world.
Very. I mean, back then it just seemed like a night that you weren't going to compete as hard.
Right.
You know, the doing events in LA on the weekends, it can be very, very
competitive.
Extremely. I mean, this is one of the most competitive markets in the world for nightlife.
Oh, yeah. I mean, last weekend there was probably 6 parties that I wanted to go to, I think.
I mean, Doc, there's probably 100 events happening on any Friday or Saturday night out here.
So, I mean,
you're up against family events. You're up against big concerts.
Totally.
You know, you kind of, when you're operating Wednesday, I feel like it's kind of a safe place.
Yeah, Wednesday you get to be the big fish in a small pond, kind of.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's okay. So that's very logical, and you already were thinking of that back then. And so, Low End Theory, obviously, in the time it's been running, has caught on with a multitude of celebrity musicians or just celebrities in general. Like, you end up with people that perhaps, you know, you're surprised to find out that you've been influencing them or whatever. So at the time with Concrete Jungle, did it catch on like that? Were, like, celebs starting to kind of get in on the action?
A little bit. Not quite what, you know, Low End Theory became.
Yeah.
But, you know, we had our people that were heads.
Yeah.
You know, probably our most, you know, famous person would come regularly was probably John Frusciante.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was there, like, every week.
Really? Was he in Chili Peppers at the time?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And then Chad Muska.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Skater.
He was one of our heads.
Right, right. He used to be a big style icon to me.
Yeah. I mean, Tom Cruise would pop in.
No shit.
Uh-huh.
That's crazy. Tom Cruise.
He used to love Mirror One, because Mirror One would paint.
Oh, live painting.
Yeah, and he would just post up.
Yeah,
watch a Mirror, you know.
What was the demise of Concrete Jungle? Why'd you guys end it?
We kind of just had a falling out with the venue.
Okay.
We just, you know, we were a lot to handle.
Yeah.
There was fights, the noise, us constantly battling with them to make it louder, and it wasn't loud enough. And then one night, the owner, we had a sound guy who would bring in sound, and then the owner was like, you can't have sound in here anymore like that, and we just bailed.
Mm.
That was it.
It was in the Space Nights in Hollywood, yeah?
Or Silver Lake.
Silver Lake, okay. Did you feel like Concrete Jungle was like kind of a graduation from where you're throwing parties at warehouses and having to make give people maps and everything? Did it feel like just a little more official to do it in a venue? Or like, why did you choose to go in a venue rather than just stay into the warehouse scene?
Well, I mean, the segue to that would have been when I was in college.
Uh-huh.
And I ran for this office where I was the director of entertainment at UCSD for a year.
Oh, so you're like booking the shows and stuff?
Yeah. So yeah. I was booking all the shows, and I did this big, there's this thing down there called the Sun God Festival, and I did that.
That still goes on, doesn't it?
It sure does.
Yeah.
It's a multi-thousand person thing. And,
right.
And that was really my graduation into doing more legit shows.
Dealing with agents and stuff like that.
Yep. And then through that, I kind of learned how to negotiate that. And then doing Concrete, a weekly is a whole nother, you know, ball of wax.
Right.
It's a lot more intensive because a lot about, you know, what will spell your success as a weekly is going to be your momentum.
And consistency.
Consistency, and, promotions, booking.
Right.
You know, I mean, and doing it in advance.
Yeah.
You really got to be on top of it. So that, but all of that, and we made plenty of, I mean, I learned a lot from that situation of the rise of it, to the demise of it, the role that residents play in a weekly club, and tried to parlay all of that into Low End Theory.
Yeah. And so what you're mid to late 20s at that time doing that?
Late 20s, yeah.
Is it just kind of like the final fallout, just kind of young man hot-headedness type of shit?
Yeah. Yeah. We just weren't thinking that thinking in the future.
Right.
We're just like, you know, and at that point, I mean, we'd had some bad things happen down there.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like, you know, we had my friend Miley, who died, you know, driving home from there. And
oh, geez.
As part of, you know, when Peace got in the accident. And, you know, that's you know, at that point, I was kind of ready for a break.
That's like a drunk driving thing, or what?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Mm-hmm. Were you involved in music production the whole time that you were doing that, too?
Yes. That's when I was full board, you know, producing. And then also running Celestial.
Yeah.
And then...
Talk about Celestial a little bit for people that don't know.
That was kind of all born out of the same thing. When we started with the Phoenix Orion record, when we started Celestial, it was just a one-off. We just needed a name to put on the jacket.
The back, right.
And then we did the Super Nat thing. And then we got a deal. You know, we got a distribution deal from Caroline.
And oh, yeah.
They broke us off. I mean, you know, I think we got $25,000, you know,
nice.
off the top. And that was, for us, that was the most money I'd ever seen
right.
at one time. And
that's like an advance? Did you have to pay it back or what?
Yeah, it was an advance.
Yeah.
It was, and of course, you know, we spent it like it was not an advance.
Right.
You know, I mean, I want to say the first day, you know, me and Hive went to Guitar Center and dropped like 10 grand. You know?
Oh, shit.
Yeah, man. I mean, and then...
I didn't know that Guitar Center sells cocaine. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I mean, we just bought like microphones,
yeah,
an extra
right,
Pro
right.
Tools card. And then,
yeah.
And then we lived off it. You know, we paid rent
yeah.
for our studio/house.
It seems like a ton of money, but I'm sure it goes fast.
It went in like 8 months.
Yeah.
You know, and then because we were buying, you know, kegs of beer and weed and
right,
pizza.
Right.
And then we ran out of money. So we asked them for another advance, which they gave to us. They gave us like 50 grand.
Wow. How many records had you guys put out?
At that point, maybe just a handful. But the Phoenix one did really well. It sold like 10,000 units.
Oh, know? Wow.
So it was... At that point, but we never put out another record that did numbers like that.
Right.
So at the beginning, they're like, oh, okay, these dudes are actually doing some solid units. But we never followed it up. And
was this your first experience taking something from like an idea into an official business? Like, did you guys do the whole like fake business name and
yeah,
the official papers with lawyers and
LLC,
all that shit?
Yeah, LLC, yeah. The whole nine. Yeah, that was my first.
And that was your learning experience with that?
Yes.
And so that's probably gone on to like... help you in so many ways in the long run. Was that experience?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, and then we had a big breakup. You know, we got into a beef with Phoenix because at the time it was a 4-person partnership in the label, me, Hive, Phoenix, and then Hive's manager. Hive and his manager broke up. And then everyone took sides.
Yeah.
And then it was like a divorce.
Right.
So then that's when we had to ask for the more money because we'd already run through a bunch of it. Then we had to pay those dudes out, and we had nothing left.
Yeah.
And we had to pay royalties, you know, because at that point, you know, we re-released Beneath the Surface, and we needed to, like, pay the artists that we were releasing music on. So we're like, hey, we need more money, you know?
Yeah.
And we got another 50 grand. That lasted us another 2 years.
Yeah.
And then we just ran through it and then just ran itself into the ground, you know?
Yeah. What's that feeling like with the breakup? Did you feel like, oh, shit, what now? Like, did it make your future seem bright or did it make your future seem like, oh, I'm fucked?
I mean, at that point, it's pretty dramatic.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? I mean, that was like my dream to launch a label and to, you know, have it teetering, you know, with your friends.
Right.
You start it, you know, when you start a label with friends... you know, you're not thinking about splitting up all this money, you know?
So, man, how about it? I feel like the biggest business mistake is going into business with friends.
It can be. I mean,
it just ruins friendships.
I mean, well, you want to be going into business with people who know how to do business.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, and when you're young, no one knows how to do business yet. So,
yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not like you get all these MBAs coming into the music business.
Right.
Okay. I mean, you know, most of this is like you learn it through other things and you're improvising. And that's a tough place to be, you know?
But at the same time, like to see the positive aspect, a lot of learning comes through failure.
For sure.
Right? So that had to be a great learning experience in the failure because you kind of like try to learn what not to do in the future.
I mean, arguably, that's what Concrete Jungle was for me. That's what Celestial Recordings was for me.
Right.
I had to, like, fall flat on my face on multiple levels to then, you know, get up again,
yeah,
do Alpha Pup and do Low in Theory.
Yeah. So from a, like a real human aspect, I feel like sometimes, like I've been through those failures, you know what I mean? Where I'm like, oh, I'm so heartbroken and I feel like my world is crumbling because this thing that I love just fell apart in front of me. And it takes me a while to reset and go like, oh, wait, I'm like re-inspired and now I want to fucking start a new venture that hopefully I won't fail in. How long did it take you after Celestial to kind of be like, I have big ideas again?
After Celestial, I went to work for Sony for 2 years.
What were you doing there?
I was a label manager at Sony Corp America.
And was that, at the time, did it feel like I just need something in the meantime? Or did it feel like I'm settling for this? Or was it like, this is the biggest opportunity ever?
It was an opportunity.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a great salary.
Yeah.
And it was something that I really wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I was producing less. I was still doing some stuff. But, you know, I kind of went in on that for a while just to taste it and see what it was all about. But it was there that the idea for Alpha Pup was born.
What were your responsibilities there?
You know, I was a label liaison. So I would deal with, you know, just concerns. I mean, I would deal quite a bit with one of my main accounts was the, you know, Sony BMG music groups.
Yeah.
So just taking their desires and, you know, what they wanted to do with Sony Corp. And we had this thing running called Sony Connect at the time. It was kind of like a download store.
Mm-hmm.
And working with them. And that's when I realized that there was a huge, that there was a void for doing a more boutique digital distribution type operation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I started Alpha Pup when I was still on Sony salary.
So this is what the early aughts or like the, like,
mid-aughts, 2003, 2004.
Okay.
We started Alpha Pup February 2004.
And so iTunes is like brand new at that point,
brand
right?
Brand new. Like, yeah, less than a year old.
Because I put out a record in 07 and I remember it being like, should we put it on iTunes or not type of thing. Like it was still very optional. And now it's like, you got to have it on iTunes, obviously. Like that's the route to getting it everywhere else almost. Like,
yeah. And what was great was that my main contact at BMG was this dude, Kirk Bonin, who when he was leaving, he went to Apple.
Oh.
So that was my hookup.
That's the plug.
Yeah, for getting the direct deal and in the future doing all the promotions and introducing me to the staff.
Right. So what was the – I don't know that there's ever a huge moment for an idea, but like what was the initial inspiration for Alpha Pup in that like if you had an elevator pitch for it, what was your description of what you were trying to do?
You know, just a more streamlined operation, smaller op,
yeah.
That it was about quality music versus quantity because back then it was all about volume.
Right.
You know, how many titles do you have versus how few titles do you have that are actually going to sell?
Right.
So, and then back then that was when I met Armin Baladian, who owns Westbound, which is like the Funkadelic, old Funkadelic catalog and Ohio Players stuff. And then they became one of our first big clients.
Right. How did you meet him?
Through at working at Sony.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so they were just looking for digital distribution and you're like,
no, they didn't even,
they don't know what it was.
Thinking about it. Yeah.
Right.
But you know, I cold called him to try to get him down with what Sony was doing. And just formed a relationship after calling him over and over and over again. And
right.
And then we just, when Alpha Pup launched, I was like, hey, this is what I'm doing. How do you feel about us introducing Funkadelic to iTunes?
Yeah.
And so that's what we did.
They were open to it.
Totally.
The Sony Connect thing, how long did that last?
You know, a few years, maybe 3 or 4 years. I mean, I left, you know, when Alpha Pup started really going.
You left before that? Yeah, before that ended?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that must have been one of those things, like, when iTunes takes over, like, everybody else just kind of bowed out.
I mean, there's still people playing it, but, yeah, I mean, that ended. I'm not sure when it did.
Yeah.
It got folded into PlayStation Network.
At what point did you end up recording maybe your most, like, recognizable beat with AWOL rhythm? And it do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, right?
Yeah.
Okay, what year is that did you get?
That's 2000.
Yeah.
You know, Celestial's still going.
Is that, like, during the Concrete Jungle time, too?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. And when that happened, AWOL was kind of, like, next up at that point, right?
Yeah, felt like it.
Yeah.
I mean, we had put out a record for him, the Speaker Face record on Celestial.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, we formed a friendship And then we had these sessions that went on every week for like a few months. We'd come over, I think it was on Tuesdays. And we, you know, each session I'd have, we'd record the beats I'd given them the previous week.
Yeah.
And then I'd give them some new beats. And then Rhythm was the last of those sessions.
Oh, it was the last one.
Yep.
Did he just kind of like, did you know when you made that beat, like, oh, this is something?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, and then, you know, the record was called Sold Out.
Yeah.
It came out and it blew up. I mean, it sold really well.
I mean, from personal context, that was right when I moved to California. It was in like 2000, and Shapeshifters and AWOL1 were like, They were the main support, I would say, for like every show I was going to. They were going on right before the headliner at like almost every LA show.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, they were the buzz back then. I mean, it was almost like there was about to be a major breakthrough.
Right.
It felt like it.
Right. Right.
And then we were getting courted by Epitaph.
Oh yeah.
You know,
cause they were signing like rappers at that time.
That was the gateway record. I mean, you know, Andy Calkin would tell you.
Yeah.
Sold Out was the record that introduced him to underground rap.
Because
we're getting a bunch of press, you know, Spin, all these people were about it.
Yeah.
But then he found Atmosphere.
Yeah.
So that was a lot more.
That was very
interesting.
Marketable. Right. Very palatable.
And Sage France. I took him to his first Sage Francis show.
Yeah. Didn't Bus Driver put out a record on Epitaph too?
He sure did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but then, you know, and at that point too, again, what I was doing, you know, me and AWOL made a few more. We made another two albums after that. I got caught up with Mush Records, which was a disaster.
Huh.
But they had money.
Yeah.
You know, so back then it was like, all right, you know, you got 10 grand to pony up.
Yeah.
To give an advance. You know, guess what? I'll be there, you know?
It's funny to hear, like, oh, Mush was a disaster, because I look at, like, the beginning of me starting to rap, I was like, ooh, I would love to be on Mush, because they put out ASAP Rock, or ASAP Rock,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I would look at their roster and be like, well, Mush is, like, really on, but I've heard nothing but horror stories in the long run.
You know, it is what it is.
Yeah,
know,
for sure.
Learning
blah,
experience.
Blah, blah. Yeah, learning experiences. So, how's that feeling of the AWOL buzz taking off and like hearing your beats kind of everywhere with
we
that?
Were on the radio. I mean, 2001,
yeah.
We were on Power 106.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
That was my biggest song. It still is.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. I mean, I feel like you can still throw that on at certain parties and it'll fucking go off, you know? Okay. So you're at Sony, start Alpha Pup. Who's your first signee at Alpha Pup?
Paris Zex.
Right.
So who produced Imaginary Places? Bus Driver.
Bus Driver, yeah. And so did you have him in mind when your curation, when you're coming up with the idea in your head and you're like thinking about artists that you want to show to the world, is he the first one that pops up? Like, this will be perfect?
Yeah, because we were friends. He was working on a record, an instrumental record.
Yeah.
That was 2005. We put that out. And, you know, he was just right in front of me.
Yeah.
You know, so it was a logical decision. Yeah.
Did you always have more of a hankering for like instrumental records over rap records?
No. I mean, the most of my production has been for rappers.
For rappers. But at the same time, don't you get like rappers are pains in the ass to deal with. Like you got to get sick of them at a certain point. Yeah.
Can be. I mean, it depends who it is. But, you know, at that point too, I think things were just changing.
Yeah.
You know, and then a year later, Low End Theory starts.
Yeah. So tell me, okay. So even before Low End Theory starts, I know that you already had to have seen this shift in the momentum in Los Angeles where it seemed to me at the time living through it, like there was a whole collective of producers who were just kind of getting sick of dealing with rappers, but they were also making beats that were probably better than a lot of the rappers that were around, I guess, in hindsight. So what was your first kind of like glimpse into that bubbling scene or like the murmurs that you were hearing about it?
Well, we did this Alpha Pup party.
Yeah.
You know, and then also an artist we had on the label was Edit from Glitch Mob and then a lot of the early Glitch Mob stuff. So basically, it was 2005 summer. We did an Alpha Pup free show at Echo.
I think
we had Edit headlining. And we had Subtitle playing, who we also had put a record out on, and Blackbird, who was produced by Paris Zex. And then Edit tells me about this dude he knew, I think he'd met him through MySpace, named Flying Lotus.
Yo, Flying Lotus, MySpace was cracking at the time.
But this is even before it was like full tilt. This is 2005, you know,
I was super aware back then, even because I went, I've always thought in my head, and I fucked this story up telling it before, because I thought that show at the Echo was the first Low End Theory, but it was just an Alpha Pup party.
It was an Alpha Pup party.
But James was involved with that, right? He hosted, or either him or Tumex.
Tumex performed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so, and that was the day I met Fly Low.
Really? Okay,
so that was June 2005.
I drove from Santa Barbara to go to that show.
Nice. Yeah, it was a free show. Remember, it was free?
Yeah.
So, and we had him open, you know, because no one knew who he was at that point. I mean, it wasn't his first show, but it had to have been one of the first.
Right.
And I remember he showed up with this laptop that was like the size of a couch. You know, it was just this huge PC laptop running Traktor. Gaslamp Killer played that same show.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a precursor, you know, to what would happen then a year and change later.
Yeah.
And about almost a year later, I didn't really stay in touch with Fly Low. I mean, we did online.
Yeah.
Then there was
Did he already have, like, the cartoons on his MySpace? Because that was the thing. Like, there's some cartoon artist that was drawing, like, him and DiBiase.
Charles Munka. Yeah, that was by next year. That was by 2006. So then basically we it was another year later. And there was this party called Space Invaders that was happening in L.A. and SF.
Uh-huh.
This is the infamous van ride to San Francisco.
Right.
At that point, too, I was, speaking of bus driver, I was mixing the Roadkill Overcoat record with DJ Nobody, who produced two-thirds of that record. That was me and Elvin reconnecting after many years of not hanging out. I had met him in the late 90s because he came through the auditorium for his first record on Ubiquity, the Soulmates record.
What's the auditorium?
That was the Celestial Studio slash Flophouse that we had.
Okay.
So then, and I remember I had a gig in SF. I didn't have a ride. I knew that Elvin, DJ Nobody, was going up there because he was going to there with Prefuse and all these people.
Yeah.
So he hit up Lojero, Andrew Lojero, who, you know, was organizing the party. He was like, hey, can Kev stow away in the van? Because they had like multiple vans going up. So then that day, you know, I show up at, I forget what time, 10 a.m., you know, we're all supposed to leave. They don't have it together. So we don't end up leaving for several hours, okay? We're like 3 hours down in this L.A. loft downtown. And Fly Low's there. And that was, we talked for hours that day.
Yeah.
And then on the van ride up, it was me, Gaslamp, and DJ Nobody sitting next to each other. In the back of this van, smoking weed.
Had you met Gaslamp before?
He played at the Alpha Pup party a year prior. So I knew Gaslamp loosely.
Right.
So then, but we just clicked. That was the moment when that part of it clicked.
The three of you.
The three of us. Yeah. Like, all right.
Well, also just to hear that you and Fly Low talked for 3 hours is kind of like, so he must have seen something in you as well. Because I feel like he doesn't talk to a lot of people for very long.
Well, we were becoming, that was the genesis of our friendship.
Yeah.
You know, that day.
Yeah.
And then... So then I remember, so the next day, I do my gig, not at their party. And then the next day, me and Elvin and Mia Doy Todd are driving back. And Elvin's going off about how great Gaslamp was, how dope that dude was, how it was the best set of the night. I was like, no shit. Okay, dope. So we all get back to LA. This is over the summer. And then I want to say it was a month later, I go to a birthday party at the airliner. So this dude, Nathan Nice. I don't even remember this guy at all.
I do. I vaguely do, yeah.
And then that was my first time there. I was like, whoa, this is dope. I think on the way home, I called Edit.
Yeah.
You know, again, we were putting out his record on Alpha Pup.
Because he was one of the original...
From Concrete.
Yeah. But so, also, he was one of the original residents at Lowen.
Lowen.
Yeah.
So I called Ed. I was like, dude, I found the spot. I think it might be dope to do a club here. Are you in to help? You know, do a club with me again.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, man, you know, and I was telling him how big it was. Then he was like, let's go down there. So we went down together and it was, you know, at that point we're like just me and him on the balcony, on the patio. And he's like, man, this is a big spot. We're going to need more people.
Right.
Who should we get? And I immediately was like, you know, DJ Nobody and Gaslamp.
Yeah.
I think that'd be the shit. Cause I just, you know, hung with those guys. He was like, yeah, dude. Okay. Dope. So that was the original four. We brought No Can Do on like about a week before the first one.
Right.
But the original idea was, the conception was those four.
Because you had signed him as an artist on Alpha Pup,
right?
And that seemed like conducive to co-promoting it that way. Like,
yeah, just kind of having a place for him to rock. Yeah,
right, absolutely. Right. Totally. And So how did it go, the first one?
Slow.
Really?
I think we had two mechs headline. I mean, if, when you look at the first flyer, you know, we booked Flying Lotus for the second one.
Yeah.
So when we launched it, we had the first four nights already done.
Yeah.
You look back, it was like kind of prophetic because it was like Flying Lotus, Daedalus, a lot of the people, Kutma.
Right.
You know, well, and that's, Glitch Mob, you know, the guys who basically formed the fabric for what ended up happening.
So even before that, I remember like DiBiase telling me about something that they used to do at Little Temple or something.
Sketchbook.
Yeah. Did you still go to that?
I never went to Sketchbook.
Yeah. Like I'm just wondering, like, when you started Low End Theory, did you kind of have this curation of like, yo, there's this little murmur that I see happening that I think is going to grow? Or was it just like, I'm going to trust the opportunities that the universe presents to me?
It was more like just doing another club like that I knew how to do.
Yeah.
I want to say our headliners for the first month were all rap acts,
supported by
Tumex, first one. It was Scarab the next week,
right?
I mean, and then it was like, but Flying Lotus was opening for Scarab, or Glitch Mob was opening for Tumex, and so that became
Nosach. Was he in the early ones?
Not in the first four, but we got him early on.
Yeah,
you know, or like Toki. You know, those were acts that we definitely booked in the first year.
Yeah.
And I want to say it was maybe a year into it. It's really when we started doing the Beat Invitationals, when we were finding our footing.
Yeah.
Of like, okay, this is what it's going to be now.
You know, one that I drove down to, or I came down to LA for it, because I was living in Santa Barbara at the time. It was like probably a year before I moved down. That was like enormous. And I was like, damn, this shit is like really something. Was Sage Francis headliner.
Yeah.
That one was like, people were literally crawling on the roof.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of our first big nights. I mean,
that was huge.
And I'd known Sage because I did work on the, you know, was it Personal Journals?
His first one on Anticon?
No, it was the next one. It was the Epitaph record.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't remember what it's called, but I know exactly.
I did Dance Monkey. So,
oh, no shit.
So that, you know, that's how I knew Sage.
Yeah.
You know, and he had a tough time that night. We didn't have our shit together. Our sound guys back then were crackheads, so it was like, yeah, I felt bad, you know. But
yeah.
He brought a lot of people out, you know.
It was enormous, yeah, yeah. So it gets off to a slow start, but it starts moving pretty. I mean, it starts gaining speed within like the first 2 years.
By 2 years into it, it's on.
Yeah, it was like fully packed every night. Yeah,
or not every night, but packed enough. I mean, we would have one really busy night a month, and then maybe one slow night, and then two medium nights.
Yeah,
not like today where it's like packed completely insane.
Right, it's just automatic every time. And that was an interesting thing, watching it, being there from, I wasn't there at the very beginning, but I was going towards the beginning, like, very consistently, and watching these dudes, like you're saying, like your Flylows, your Daedaluses, like in, you know, 06 07, walking into the venue and just being kind of faces in the crowd, to where by the time it was like 2009, I remember standing by the entrance and Steve walks in and like the crowd parts like the Red Sea and they look as though Jesus himself has just arrived. And I went like, wow, this fool has really he's made it in this little arena. You know what I mean? Like I was standing with Avocado, who I think you've met. He's done a lot of my music.
Course, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it turns out they went to film school together and Kyle didn't know that Flying Lotus was like Flying Lotus. And Steve like walks over and like says, what's up to Kyle? And people around are like gasping, like, you know him? And he's like, well, I mean, I think we like lived next to each other in the dorms or something. Anyways, it's just insane to have seen these people that were just dudes become such huge acts and now Grammy nominees and shit. It's crazy.
Yeah, man.
And you know, you played a huge, you were a catalyst of all that, dude.
I mean, I try to be. I mean, I never take credit for, you know, these people's artistry or their brilliance. I mean, my role has been to create this platform.
Right.
And that hopefully, I mean, that, you know, can be considered to be effective. And, you know, to me, in my position, you know, it's pretty surreal, you know, to have seen it all, to see it go way bigger than you think it's ever going to go.
Right.
To have a scene that's known around the world.
Yeah, like the quote-unquote beat scene, I feel like that phrase was coined because of low-end theory, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's ground zero for it.
So tell me about that. I remember in the early days, people were trying to figure out how to compartmentalize what low-end theory was. And they were saying, initially it was like, oh, you guys are a dubstep club. And you're like, no, we are not a fucking dubstep club, right? And then they were trying to call it all these weird things like warble music or
laser bass.
Laser bass. I remember that. You had all these like weird genre names. Like, do you remember the moment when it just kind of like, oh, wait, it's like settled on this is beat scene music?
I mean, I don't even know if that's what, you know, it ever really officially became, although that's the most what it's known insofar as the scene.
Right? Yeah.
I mean,
right.
The music itself, and we purposely did that. I mean, we purposely rejected any labeling that people wanted to come up with, like when, you know, Sasha Ferrari Jones came up with laser bass. I mean, we just laughed that out of town, you know?
Yeah.
And because we didn't want to have an expiration date,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I think once you put like a, you know, really succinct label on something, all of a sudden your trajectory is determined.
Right.
Versus what I think it became was more of like this affiliation of artists who can do multiple forms of music, who are, you know, more versatile than any one thing. I mean, to me, it's definitely uncanny to have that you know, amount of raw talent coming together in one place. And ultimately, you know, I think what became inspiring to a lot of people down there was the quality of the sound system and the quality of the production of the event, that they felt that their art could be, you know,
portrayed properly,
portrayed and magnified.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like,
speaking of which, shout outs to Sam XL, who was working the sound for you guys for a long time, right?
Yeah. No,
how did you meet Sam?
I've known Sam from way back in the day, from Celestial era. I mean, he used to work at Beat Nonstop. Then he launched his own store in Melrose called Temple of Boom.
Yeah.
And Sam's old school. You know,
because, I mean, I remember one of the things that a lot of publications used to hype up was there was a spot in the upstairs room where if you stood right in the right place, it was like the maximum bass that you guys had planned out. What is developing the sound system come up with? Because I know that you're like a total, you're like totally precise sonically, and like you want everything perfect, I'm sure. So like, what was the collaboration process of deciding what it's going to sound like in there?
I mean, well, I'm the one who built the sound system upstairs. Sam,
oh, okay.
Sam does downstairs.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that was just over the course of years of building it up and tuning it, and the fact that, you know, I approached the sound system like a mastering engineer.
Yeah.
You know, there's not too many, you know, legit mastering engineers actually actively involved in live sound.
Yeah.
So, you know, I try to apply a very, you know, scientific approach to the sound system up there of, you know, very low distortion, very relatively flat response, at least on the mids and the highs. And just having a really, you know, I think part of being an engineer is your ability to articulate frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I can go into a room and hear, listen to what, you know, a song I've heard before and know what the problem, you know how it needs to be EQ'd.
How it's supposed to sound. Yeah.
How it's supposed to sound,
yeah.
For one. And number two, how to then communicate that in the language of science.
Right.
Like, all right, this right here, what I'm hearing needs to be, I need to be ducking at 4 kilohertz to, you know, 3 decibels down at 4 kilohertz with thin Q. Let's see, what else? 8.5K needs to get notched out. You know, 1K needs to get notched out, and we need to do another bump at, you know, 200 hertz.
Right.
You know, being able to hear music and did that be the feedback.
Yeah.
That to me is, you know, what I've spent many years trying to develop, and, you know, ultimately I like to think results in a very different listening experience.
As far as the scene goes in low end, well, first off, let me preface it by saying, obviously, like, Tom York has called it out as an influence, Erykah Badu, like, a ton of people have become a part of this thing that you were a catalyst in creating. Was there a moment where you started to realize, like, oh, all of a sudden, this is bigger than just some guys getting together every Wednesday, and all of a sudden, it's become an international influence? Like, was there a thing where you were like, damn, this is a real moment?
I mean, maybe the first big LA Times piece in 2009.
Yeah.
When we're like on the front of the calendar section. I mean, that was, you know, unprecedented at that point for the press. And then press caught on. I mean, we've been riding a press wave.
Ever since.
Yeah. Now.
Rolling Stone.
Everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere.
7 years. I mean, when Tom York played, I mean, that was the DJ set heard around the world. I mean,
right.
It was like,
that was what got my, I got a photograph published in Rolling Stone because I ran into you on the stairs.
I mean, that was like the front of Pitchfork, Rolling Stone, yeah. And me. I mean,
that was huge. That was
it
huge.
It was crazy.
And well, and then Erykah Badu was only like a couple months after that, maybe.
Yeah, James Blake.
James Blake, DJ Set. I shot all of those,
I
man.
Mean, Idris Elba. I mean, it's been crazy.
Yeah. You know? Are there artists that you've gotten to work with because of Low End that you're like either you never thought you would or that you're so excited to have been able to work with?
I mean, sure. Mr. Wazzo.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, all the Brainfeeder guys, Thundercat, you know, Fly Low.
Yeah.
Run the Jewels. You know, because I met LP from when he played Low End Theory.
That's right.
I mean, that's so much of what I've been able to do in the studio has been based upon the relationships I've made down there.
Going back to what I was talking about of like, does it ever get easier to define what a life's goal is? Do you feel like once Low End really got started, like, did it feel like you found a purpose perhaps? Like more so than in the past? Is there like clarity with it?
I mean, I always knew I wanted to do music.
Mm-hmm.
So this was just an instrument for that. And I, you know, I came into this with very modest expectations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never approached the music industry of like, all right, I'm going to conquer this or, you know.
I'm going to be rich.
Definitely not. I mean, you know, you do independent music long enough, you realize real quick that's not on the, you know, docket. But it's just about, you know, doing what you love, feeling passionate about it. And that's luckily what I'm able to do with Low End Theory. You know, and everything that's affiliated with it.
How do you stay so consistent with it? Because just trying to do this once a week, sometimes I'm not able to balance it. And I maybe only put out one episode a month sometimes. But you for what? You're in your 10th year now?
We're in our 10th. We're going to be turning 10
in October, right? So technically we're in the 10th year. So I don't think you've missed a Wednesday, really. Like
I'm
maybe
Cal Ripken. I've missed five, maybe.
Yeah.
For like the birth of my kids and stuff like that.
Yeah. And so how do you stay inspired every week to make a lineup and to get it together? Like what keeps it going for you?
I mean, I have a strong family. I feel like my family is my primary source of inspiration. And I've never had a problem being inspired.
Staying motivated,
yeah. I mean, I was slept on for many years in the beginning of my career. I think that's good because, you know, it makes it so you're not taking things for granted, because when you do reach a certain threshold of success, you're going to mash hard to keep that.
Yeah.
Because you remember what it was like to not be there versus people who, you know, blow up right off the top.
Do you ever, and this may be a weird question, but do you ever let old spites inspire you a little bit? Like people that, like moments where you're like, oh, this fool is sleeping on me. Do you let that inspire you of like, they're not going to sleep on me anymore?
To a certain degree.
Yeah.
But, you know, these days, you know, I try not to operate from, you know, a point of negativity.
Right.
I mean, I've already snuffed out a few people, you know what I mean? So it's like, I've already experienced that and won those wars and, you know, I didn't get the inspiration from that I thought I would.
Right.
You know, if anything, you regret, you know, things like that. It just comes down to, you know, I think the kind of motion and the forward motion that, you know, you ideally want to be operating with is positive forward motion.
Right. At this point, you're really only competing against yourself.
I think that's the point. I think everyone's that way.
Yeah.
You know, that's if you're doing independent music, you are your own competition.
Right.
I mean, yeah, back in the day, there was people I was like, why is that person more successful than me, you know?
And right.
That mode of thinking is ultimately self-destructive.
Absolutely. You led into a good segue there. You talk about how this is important for you and your family and like, or like how you have a strong family that helps you stay motivated. Well, how long ago did you meet your wife?
2001.
In 2001. So right when kind of things are starting to crack with Celestial then or what?
It was the end.
It was the end of that.
Yeah.
She was
arguably kind of what...
She was the Yoko Ono?
Yeah, no, kind of. It was like, you know, Celestial was becoming a real pain in the ass. We had this lawsuit that was happening, and I was like, man, I'd rather just kick it with this chick than deal with these guys all day, you know?
Right. Did you know from jump, like, that was it? Like, she was the one?
I felt like that, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how long was it until you guys got married?
We got married August 8th, 2008.
Oh, okay. So you guys, yeah.
80808.
Because
I'm half Chinese, so again, that's a very lucky day,
right?
You know, eight is,
but also 808 drums
had multiple
meanings,
connotations,
mad meanings.
Yes,
yeah.
But you know, we had our first child in 2007. Oh, okay. Excuse me, 2008. My daughter was born earlier that year. My daughter was like 3 months. She was pregnant in 2007.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have three kids now, you know.
I mean, here's the thing. You've always been like the OG to me that I look up to and kind of – so like you've always seemed like wise and you have wisdom to be dropped upon – or like to drop upon people, whether you feel that way or not. So I guess at the time when like you guys get pregnant, were you like, oh shit, or were you like, oh cool, I've been ready for this? Because like you've always seemed like a wise person to me, but who knows? Maybe you feel just as immature as I do.
I mean, I thought I was ready. I mean, you know, the pregnancy is the easy part.
Right.
You know, it's when they're born. I mean, not even when they're born. It's like a month or two later. That's when it gets tough.
Really?
Yeah, that's when, the, you know, you're dealing with the sleepless nights. And then we had a second child. That turns it up exponentially.
Right.
And then our third has been a real centering energy.
Yeah. How old is the third now? Pretty new.
Yeah, 8.5 months.
8.5 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys going to keep going or what?
No, I think we're out. I'm out the game, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you find time to balance everything, family, work? I mean, you, and that's the thing is you have multiple work angles too, because you got, you run in the label, you're running low end, you're working on multiple audio projects at all times. How do you?
I mean, I got my routine, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, my morning starts. I usually try to get up at least an hour before the kids are up. So usually 5 a.m.
Right.
You know, I'm up. You know, I'm getting most of my emails done then.
Yeah.
So I don't, I'm not on email all day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of old school in that way, you know. I usually do email once a day, mm-hmm. sometimes twice. At the end. You know, it depends. If I'm knowing there's some real, like it's going
to
be an intense
something you
day.
Need to be attentive to, then you will.
Or like Mondays usually, I try to not schedule sessions.
Right.
Just because I, you know, those are usually the most business intensive days.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, with my kids, it's made, it's forced the issue of having to be really strict with my scheduling, because, you know, I usually take my kids to school, two of them at least, and then I pick up my daughter at 3.
Uh-huh.
So I have to, you know, fit all this stuff in, because by the time I'm picking up my daughter, that's it for me
right.
for the day. Unless, again, I'm DJing that night, or I have, you know, I don't really do night sessions anymore. So it's just about, and then the weekends too, I'm with my kids the whole time.
Right.
So, which I enjoy more than anything, you know?
Yeah.
So that really has kind of forced the issue and of trying to cram as many things into between the hours of
business
9 to 2:30 every day. And, but it's a good thing. You know, I think the best thing I've learned getting older is just to not take on too much.
Mm.
I hate that feeling of being overwhelmed or, you know,
right.
And the product suffering because of it. So, you know, I've gotten a lot better at just saying no to stuff.
Right.
And raising my mastering prices and engineering prices to the point where,
right.
You know, if you're going to play ball over here, it's, you know, not going to be cheap.
I mean, at this point, you got to be pretty confident that the mastering demand is not going to dry up for you anytime soon.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, arguably, it's funny. My wife says, you know, that I'd probably make more money if that's all I did.
Right.
Because of how many people I turned down.
Right.
And how lucrative it is for me.
What have you felt change in yourself since having kids?
It's been a centering force for me.
Yeah.
It's been the biggest source of inspiration since meeting my wife, because I feel like these are all an extension of that, you know, love. And you can approach it different ways, you know. For me, I'm all in with it. I know that once my first child was born that I wasn't going to be able to do a touring career anymore.
Right.
That was no longer on the menu.
Uh-huh.
And I know people that do it and they can't. I mean, I don't know. Call me old fashioned. I think it's hard to imagine trying to raise my kids being on the road 6 months out of the year.
Right. You right.
I don't know if you can really, if there's enough FaceTime or enough phone calls that are going to take the place of, you know what I mean? And
right.
I made a decision that I was going to be there for my kids,
mm-hmm.
you know, the whole way.
Mm-hmm.
I derive power from that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never see it as like they're taking anything away from my career.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if anything,
they inspire it.
They give me what I need to come in here and do the best possible work that I can, because, you know, it ultimately reflects on them.
Right. Right. You know? I mean, about 3 years ago, you started this studio.
Yeah.
Approximately 3 years ago.
Yep.
And before that, you had the Alpha Pup studio downtown.
Yep.
And so throughout your whole career in music, you've been, whether it be like a recording session engineer or a mastering engineer, like you've known how to do this for a long time. Did you take schooling for this?
I didn't. I mean, I just learned on the job, you know, from getting into you know, production.
Yeah.
That was my first real schooling on it.
Yeah.
You know, my old roommate Hive, he was a great engineer. So him teaching me all these techniques, and he had this dude he brought on to mix for him, this guy Scott Wolf, who was one of my early mentors. He used to mix for like Dre and then went on to be Timbaland's like main guy for like the Aaliyah, you know, era. And that dude would just school us, you know, just how everything we were doing was so wrong. And, you know, and a lot of the ideas that he gave me back then, I still use today in mix. And then when we were doing Celestial, we were having all of our records mastered at Capitol by this one guy, Evren Gochnar. He would kind of do these under the table deals for us.
Yeah.
As well as some that were on the books. And I did about 10 records down there with him.
Uh-huh.
And after doing, you know, doing 10 mastering sessions with the same guy in the same studio, you kind of, you know, the whole time I'm quizzing him on stuff. Like, hey, why'd you do that? Or, you know, what, you know, what's happening at this part
soaking
of the phase?
Soaking up game.
So, yeah, I basically, and then there was a record we needed to do where we couldn't afford it. Our deal with Caroline fell apart. You know, I forget which record it was, but then I just decided to try it.
Yeah.
All right, you know, I'm just going to try mastering.
Yeah.
Because I've seen it enough times. I got Pro Tools at the house. Let me give it a whirl. Uh-huh. And then, you know, that was probably 2002.
So now 14 years later.
Yeah, I mean,
I always tell people that are interested in engineering at all, whether it be from a beat making producer standpoint or whether it be from an engineering standpoint, like your Twitter is one of the like best little hidden gems on the internet when it comes to like cheat codes and just maneuvers for mastering. Like,
those are my most popular tweets. I mean, on social media, you know, that's generally what people want to hear from me the most.
Yeah.
You know, it's a culmination of, you know, again, over, I mean, from production, you know, when I started in, you know, 97, you know, we're approaching 20 years of doing this kind of stuff. And, you know, there's a lot of things of mistakes I've made in the past. I'm just trying to help people along and, you know, throw some ideas out there. The thing is, you know, with engineering, you know, there's no one way to do it. It's not an absolute science.
Right.
But there's a lot of like guidelines that you can start from.
Right.
And that's usually what I encourage people to do. I mean, anything I'm spouting out there is like, hey, this is just a one way to do it. You know, there's many ways, you know, to skin a cat, you know, it's just about what, you know, having some starting point. And having done it long enough and been in enough situations, I mean, my discog is approaching 350 albums or, you know, EPs. So
what are some of the most, I wouldn't say biggest, but like the most important to you that you've done?
Oh, so many. It's hard to name. I mean, I've done almost every Brainfeeder record that's come out.
Yeah. So like all the Flying Lotus records.
As well as every Flying Lotus record since the Warp, his Warp deal.
Yeah.
You know, Wazo, the last time we ever Wazo records for Ed Banger and Brainfeeder and everywhere else. I did the Odessa record, you know, endless hip hop records,
Bus Driver records,
Milo's last thing,
Bath's records,
Tokyo Monster,
Thundercat.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have like a lot of notches on your belt when it comes to that. I find it so interesting that you didn't have to take any schooling for it, because I always kind of, when people ask me advice on stuff, I'm kind of like, yo, if you are really passionate about something, you'll teach yourself. And that's kind of proof in case right there, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I might have figured it out quicker, you know, if I'd gone to school for it. But I think there's a certain amount of what I do that is based in philosophy, you know, and it's based in my approach. You know, I mean, one thing about my approach to engineering, at least, you know, mixing and mastering, is that, you know, I try not to have a sound. Okay, I try not to have of, you know, a preconceived notion going into it. I feel that, you know, when I'm mastering, right, it's a bunch of songs, you know, I've never heard before. All the instructions that I need to do, you know, everything that I need to do in sequence, those instructions shouldn't be coming from my head.
They're from what's in front of you.
They're coming out of the speakers.
Right.
And my job is to take those instructions and translate them.
Take your bias out of it and try to present what the artist was doing?
Or the music. Sometimes the music has a better idea.
Have you ever heard Steve
Albini
talk about that?
A bit, yeah.
Because I think he was on Marin or somebody, and I listened to him, and he, like, his approach is very similar. He's like, look, man, like, when I'm trying to master somebody's shit or mix it, it's like, I have to, like, try to take myself out of it.
That's what I do entirely. I mean, it's about, for me, I kind of call it like a Zen approach to it. You know what I mean? Like, you removed your ego, and you're there as an instrument on the behalf of the music. And, you know, all the techniques that I've practiced for all these years, you know, kind of become unconscious to a large degree. So
mm-hmm.
I'm just kind of guiding myself through with the techniques that I've honed, and usually yeah. I'm not improvising a whole lot. I'm not trying new, you know, approaches or new things. I'm right. going with what I've developed. And
well, and that's so interesting how laser focused your ears are at this point too. Cause like we brought our record into you a couple years ago to get mastered, and instantly you listened to about 5 seconds of each song and went, well, this needs to be turned up this much. This needs to go down this much. Da, 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 da. And then the first master was essentially perfect. And it was just like, whoa, you fucking nailed it. And the funny thing is, in all of our previous records, when we've hired mastering artists, Mark, who's much more particular about the sound than I am, is like, this is terrible. This is terrible. He's doing a terrible job. I should have just done it myself. And this time when you sent over the first master, he was like, I'm about to cry. He's like, this is perfect. And so anyway, yeah, it's crazy to watch, man.
I think that part of it, I mean, it's just a lot of mastering is experience.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And doing it over and over and getting the negative feedback,
right.
making those mistakes to the point where you don't ever want to hear that. I mean, I try to knock it out of the park on the first draft every time.
Yeah.
And the same thing goes for the quality of work that I'm trying to perform. I'm trying to go A+
right.
every single time. I there's never a session, even if I don't even like the music
yeah.
or the music's not connecting with me, I will still try to do the best sounding record I've ever done in my career every single time.
Right.
That level of commitment to the art of this is what, at this point, people expect from me. I'm aware of this. You know, I embrace that part of it, you know, versus trying to be like, oh, you know, I'm just going to sleepwalk through this, which plenty of engineers do.
Right.
I think one of the reasons I have a clientele that keeps coming back is because they know I care.
Right.
You know, and that they know that I approach it like if it were my own.
Right.
Which, you know, luckily, having produced a bunch of records, having mixed a bunch of records, you know, that gave me the fortitude, you know, to be able to operate like that versus someone who just only mastered from the day one or just only mixed from day one. You're not able to really derive the connection that these artists have to their music. You know?
Right, right. You can empathize with what they're feeling by handing over their baby to you.
Yeah, I know what it is. Yeah, we're giving birth in there, you know?
Right,
it's
totally.
Like I'm the one catching the baby, you know?
Yeah, for sure. How do you feel about how the studio's turned out? Because like this has been a real labor of love for you.
Yeah, you've seen it develop. I mean,
it's been amazing to watch.
It's been, you know, I feel like I'm never kind of done with it, but, you know, I'm feeling great. You know, in the main room now, killing.
Dude, people like jaws drop when they see the main room when they come in.
That's the idea.
Yeah,
it's beautiful. You're supposed to be inspired, you know?
Yeah, totally, man. I just want to thank you for letting me be a part of this space and using it consistently. It's been awesome for just me to be able to pursue my passions in here. And so thank you so much for that, just for giving me that opportunity. But also just for all like the knowledge you've kicked over the years to me, man. It's been very important influence in my life and career. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Lee. Congratulations on 100 episodes.
Hey, thank you, man.
Thanks for having me through.
That we could have the guy in that helped manifest all of this.
Let's do another 100.
Yeah, you know? absolutely. Yeah. Tell the people where they can find you online.
You know, Twitter is a good place for me.
At Daddy Kev.
Yeah, twitter.com/DaddyKev. Instagram.com/DaddyKev.
Yeah.
Those are my main social medias. I'm not on Facebook a whole lot, but, you know, Low in Theory, we're the first thing that comes up. You
can absolutely. Every Wednesday. Are you going to keep going with Low in Theory indefinitely or what? Do you have long-term plans with it?
You know, at this point, I mean, we've talked about what are we going to do?
Yeah.
Is there going to be an end date
that
we transition to just the festival or a monthly? But,
right.
You know, where my head is at now,
mm-hmm.
I'm ready to just to ride this so the wheels fall off.
Yeah.
You know, I'm down to do this until they tell us we can't do it anymore.
Right, right. Absolutely, man. Yeah, like I said, if you guys have any interest at all in home studio production or recording engineering on your own time, definitely follow Kev on Twitter because he's like constantly dropping jewels. And I've tagged my producer in an uncountable amount of times on his Twitter about like advice. So thanks, man. Again, just thank you for everything. I appreciate it. My name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition. You can find me on Twitter at It's Intuition. Follow my man behind the boards, making the shit sound buttery, Ben Shim at I Am Database. Base with two S's. Follow us as a unit at Kinda Neat. Kindaneat.net. Everything wrapped up in a pretty package. Subscribe on the podcast app. Search for Kinda Neat. Subscribe. Leave a 5-star rating. Oh, we're going to start a Patreon. That's the new thing. So if you're still listening right now, in order to try and just kind of like help us pay the bills a little more, we are going to start using Patreon so you can pledge by the month. If you kick in a dollar a month, if we can get 1,000 people to kick $1 a month, then all of a sudden we got $1,000 a month to help us pay the bills around here. So yeah, go to our Patreon and check that out. The intro has more info. I'm recording this a week before I actually make it. So hopefully that shit goes well. I'm nervous about it. But yeah, I want to just personally thank everyone that's still listening and everyone that is tunes in consistently or doesn't and just cherry picks episodes and whatever. Thank you guys so much for these 3 years and 100 episodes. I know it took us a year longer to reach 100 episodes than it should have. But I'm so happy that you guys tune in and I'm happy to have a platform to talk to people that inspire me. And I'm just so grateful for you guys and I'm grateful for everybody that tunes into the videos and the podcasts. And yeah, without getting too sappy, just fucking thank you for coming along the journey with us for the first 100 and here's to another 100. My name is Lee. That was Daddy Kev. And this was Kinda Neat. Thank you.